From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we welcome back Tracy Ullman, and she introduces us to her latest characters, like Linda Granger, washed-up actress and infomercial star, and Chick, a New York City cabbie of indeterminate Middle Eastern origin. Ullman is back on HBO with the third season of her series Tracy Takes On, in which her characters take on a single topic like sex or money. Ullman also has a companion book. Also, Ken Tucker reviews Garth Brooks' new recording, Sevens. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It may seem as if I have many guests today, but all the voices you will hear, with the exception of mine, of course, are from the mouth of one person, Tracy Ullman. She's back on HBO with the third season of her series Tracy Takes On. In each episode, Ullman takes on a different subject, such as marriage, Hollywood, smoking, and loss. Each program is a series of comic sketches and monologues in which the characters she's created, with the help of guest stars, deal with the subject at hand. At the end of the month, her series will be available on home video. Tracy Ullman's latest characters also appear in her new book, Tracy Takes On. You're about to meet several of Tracy Ullman's characters. Tracy Ullman, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Oh, it's lovely to be back. Hello, Terry.
I'd love for you to introduce us to some of the characters that you're doing now in your series and in your new book, both called Tracy Takes On. Let's start maybe with Linda Granger, a kind of washed-up actress and professional victim.
Well, darling, I love Linda Granger. Linda loves being on National Public Radio. Linda's the kind of person that goes on public television fund drives. And she says things like, you know, public television is a wonderful thing for all of us. You know, and it's the time, don't you love those pledge drives when people like Linda Granger get to go on public television? And normally she's doing complete dross infomercials, but then she gets to go and do a pledge drive. I see Linda's around L.A. all the time, you know.
Just describe
pretending
her for
to
us.
Be 39 and they're 55, and she's had a little collagen in her lips, and my cosmetic surgeon is an artist. And as long as they're doing infomercials or they're appearing on Gay Talk on public access with her solid homosexual fan base, she's in show business, Terry. She's an inspirational speaker. She's an author. She's had cancer. She's a cancer survivor. And she has a daughter called Marmalade, because that's what they served on the muffins when I signed the adoption papers. And Linda's very glamorous. Her dream is to be in a Quentin Tarantino movie, though. Even if they just used a picture, an old VIP picture of Linda that was in the background, pinned up in a booth in a coffee shop in a Quentin Tarantino movie, she'd consider that a major comeback.
Does she seem like a cautionary tale to you of what an actress is capable of becoming if she's not careful?
She's a certain type of actress. I mean, she would do theater. Oh, theater is my first love, Terry. And she's always doing love letters with Hank Brinkley from the Channel 5 News. Do you notice the love letters pairings, Terry, got really terrible?
Oh,
they?
I know.
It was like they had to just put a stop to them.
For our listeners who don't know love letters, it's a two-person show that started off, you know, with, I think, Eli Wallach and his wife. And then as it went around the country, the stars got less and less stellar.
Yeah, Joe Namath and Phyllis Diller in love letters. The combos got kind of, but it was that sort of, you didn't have to learn the lines, and you could just sit and read it, you know, and I imagine Linda, you know, doing that show somewhere in the wilds with a pair of reading glasses from a pharmacy, you know, dinner theater.
Now, another character you're doing now is Sydney Cross, who is a lawyer. Describe what kind of lawyer she is.
When I started doing this show 3 years ago, I wanted to play like an aggressive, ambitious career woman and living in Los Angeles. And I thought, well, an agent was a little passe. And Sidney Cross, at that time, it was the O.J. Simpson trial, and we had all these lawyers going on TV every night. And I thought, do a lawyer. And the physicalities of Leslie Abramson were fascinating to me. So physically, it's a little like Leslie Abramson. I added my own sharky, gappy baby teeth, which really give me the character. And it's the voice of an agent of mine who was like crazed. Hi, Tracy, how you doing? You want to win an Oscar? We're going to win a fucking Oscar. She used to call me up every day. I think, oh, God, this woman's going to drive me crazy. And she's a relentlessly charmless litigator, and relentlessly ambitious and charmless litigator. That's how she's described. And but now she's kind of become endearing to me, Terry. This is the funny things about my characters. They are so, as gross as Sidney Cross is, I realise she's lonely. She can't get laid. You know, she's so ugly.
Not even by your cabbie
she's
character.
She's so ambitious. No, exactly. Even Chick can't do it. And she's the sort of person that lives in a very sterile sort of apartment with some unassembled Nautilus equipment in the corner that never got, you know, and pot noodles. And she's never home. And I just, you know, now I feel sorry for her. And as soon as I feel sorry for them, I can work on them even more.
Tracy Ullman is my guest, and her HBO series Tracy Takes On is in its new season, and she also has a companion book called Tracy Takes On, in which she all her characters are pictured and described, and there's little sketches with them, graphic sketches and situation sketches. And another character that you do is Trevor Ailes, who is a gay airline steward, what's the word now?
He's a steward. You don't have to say hostess.
Flight attendant.
You can't say hostess for women.
Flight attendant is the word.
I think he's still called the steward for British Airways. You know, they wear those hats that say to fly, to serve. That they still wear those in British Airways. This is based on a very nice, now retired, British Airways steward. And because of my lots of transatlantic flights over the years, going back and forth to my home in London and in Los Angeles, I used to see this guy, and very professional, kind, smart, mid-40s man who was, you know, like, very, very, yes, sir, can I get you a cocktail, a hot towel, or I'll show you what the entree will be, to all the passengers, you know. And then when he'd see me back in the galley, he could like, oh, God, you know, oh, I've had such trouble with that bitch in 3B. And he would be able to be who he is, you know, when he was gay, and he was like, you know, tell me about his fella. And lovely man. I mean, and when I'm on aeroplanes, actually, I'm very frightened of flying. I sort of imagine Trevor or try to be Trevor, then I don't get so scared. And I remember being on the flight, actually, when his last flight on the Concorde, and he asked me if I wanted to. He was told he could take the jump seat in the cockpit and land in the Concorde cockpit. And he was so sweet to me. He said, I'd like you to have that honour. I'd like you to be the one. I said, no. I said, all these years, you've got to do it. No, it'd give me great pleasure if you. I said, no. So he did land in the cockpit of Concorde. And very nice man.
What scares you about flying?
Oh, it's a lack of control. I'm a control freak. If I could fly the bloody plane. So I've always got to drive the car, you know. I just, Meryl Streep and I were on a flight back from Tunisia years ago when we just finished the film Plenty. I remember being in midair, coming back from Tunisia, laughing, drinking champagne, and bang, an engine went. And we literally started to go down. It went very quiet, and it's a terrifying experience. And we just got very, very quiet. And Meryl, who, there's some horrible tabloidy book was out about her at the time, and she said, oh, damn it, this woman's got a wonderful ending. But we didn't die. Me and Meryl are still here, and we still talk about it, and our husbands go, oh, here they go again.
Did you see your life or your character's lives flash before you?
Oh, God. I just. That's interesting. It was horrible.
Oh,
but,
I
I've never been the same since, Terry.
Gosh. Did it change your life to feel like you'd nearly died?
Yeah. I mean, it really was awful. And they had to start the engine. And I knew it was bad, Terry, because one of the stewardesses, they called them hostesses in those days, was crying. It was like, pull yourself together, would you? God, you know, you're supposed to be. She started to sit, you know, on the end of the aisle and sob. It was like, oh, dear.
My guest is Tracy Ullman. Her HBO series Tracy Takes On has begun its new season, and she has a new book called Tracy Takes On. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Tracy Ullman. You know, you say you like to be in control and you like to be the one who's driving the car. Another character that you do is Cheek the Cabbie. Right. And I'm wondering how often you actually have taken cabs in New York.
Oh, well, a lot.
Yeah.
And was always bumping into people like Cheek, who seemed to have just no sense of humor. And if you say, where are you from? You know, trying to talk, what are you, secret police? You know, one of those guys, they're immediately uptight, no humour, and very aggressive, driving aggressively, and, hey, come on, what's the matter with you? Come on, salam here, don't know. And he would always go, I remember I was in a cab one day with some guy like this, and he's going, the man this morning, I get my cab from him, and he called me a piece of shit, and I'm going to kill him. Tonight I go, I blow his brains out. I was like, I wonder if I should go to my appointment or just call the police. You know, I'm thinking, he was so aggressive and driving so aggressively. I always say to these guys, can you slow down? You know, I've got two children. I don't want to die. And the smell of English leather aftershave that wafts through the vents of the cab. And,
what happens when they find out you're in show business?
You know, I've got to move it. You know, they always say this type of chicken. You know, Martin Scorsese, I was using my cab. I said to him, I want to do a movie about Vegas, you know, gambling, and the Max Casino. What do I get from it, eh?
It's always like it was their idea.
I had Andrew Lloyd Webber in the cab, you know, I said, do a Phantom of the Opera, maybe you should do it. What does he give to Chick, eh?
Yeah, there's guys, it was always their idea.
He is of indeterminate Middle Eastern origin, and I'm wondering if you ever get any flack for, you know, when you do somebody who is of a different ethnic group than you are. I have been told by several satirists that it's a very difficult time to do satire because everybody is so kind of defensive about somebody representing or stereotyping their ethnic
political
group.
Political correctness is just so, it's just inhibiting, it's just strangling this country, you know. I mean, if you do it with the right energy and spirit, we are different. Some people do talk like this, some people do wear clothes like this, some people do eat foods like this. I mean, you know, you have to be so cautious. And I'm not a racist, I'm not doing caricatures, I'm just impersonating people I see. And I do research my characters very thoroughly. And I know that I got a bit of flack initially for the Asian character that I do. Indeterminate Asian, there you go. So you don't say where she's from either. Mrs. Nonanning. And
She's the owner of a donut shop.
Yeah, she's our donut. I know this woman. I get donuts when we're doing our writers' meetings and I think it's difficult. It was a bit shocking for the Asians because they don't really have a lot of representation in the comedy world on television. And so there was a bit of an outcry about that. And HBO defended me and said, look, she does it in the right spirit, it's with the right energy, and she has a right to do it. And then I began to get letters from teenage Asian kids, and they'd say, this is great, and you're like my grandma, and, you know, if we don't have anyone on TV that actually is Asian, at least we've got you. now she's very, you know, because my criteria for doing a character, Terry, is do they exist?
Mm-hmm.
Do people talk like this? Do they look like this? And, you know, I can impersonate them. I want to.
Did you ever run into this kind of criticism in England?
No. I have a new character in the show, The Black Lady, and that's great fun. And it was about time I did a black character. It was just difficult to do the makeup. You know, it's always time-consuming. And but that went out in my first show, and I've had a lot of response.
This is the character who works at the airport?
It's great fun. Yeah, Shanisha.
Yeah, she works at the airport at the, not the X-ray, right. What you call it, with the security thing.
Because every time I go through those things, the woman always says to me, they look at me, they go, you on TV? There's always that moment, they look at me, she on TV? And I just thought, I love those, the airports. It's totally run by these incredible black women with fabulous hairstyles. And they have a moment of supreme power when you go through that security check. I stopped at Steven Spielberg. I said, hey, you stand still. You won't get on that plane. You want to get on that plane. That plane could blow up. I'm security. Everybody, they don't have time for security. You know, and they just get mad because you don't want to stop. You don't want me to search your bag. Put your keys in a bowl and walk through again. And Adele Givens came and joined me as Helora. And Adele Givens is a brilliant comedian. I'd seen a lot of her on Deaf Comedy Jam on HBO, and she was so great with me. I mean, that would really help me to do that character because she was totally relaxed about me. Even when I began to melt under the lights, you know, and suddenly this white woman starts appearing, you know, with my makeup melted off. And she gave me this brilliant crash course in African American.
What kind of tips did she give you?
Corrected me during that. Just stuff. And it was giving me line readings during the day. And I love stuff when she gets all excited. It's on, it's on. I think I'm getting this book deal. It's on, it's go, girl. And we had a wonderful time. And it was tough to, you know, I go out there, I'm covered in black makeup, I've got this body padding on, all sorts of things, and there's a wig, and I'm standing there amongst, you know, 10 black people. I'm thinking, what am I going to do here? I'm going to join in. And so I started taking my booty, and I had a great time. And they know, you know, they accepted me, and I just do it, and I love it. I get into this fevered sort of state where I don't know who I am anymore, and that's heaven to me.
Well, do you ever really not know who you are anymore? I mean, I see all your characters, and they're all so convincing, and I think, gee, do you go through an identity crisis? Do you look in the mirror and think, I could be anybody, depending on what accent I put on or how I do my hair? I mean, you could pass for anybody.
It's weird. I guess if I was a Buddhist, which is the religion I'm most interested in, I suppose I'm reincarnated many, many times, and I have been all these people. That might be an explanation for it. The Buddhists seem to know exactly why I'm like this.
Let me stop you, because I don't think that's true, because Fern Rosenthal didn't live centuries ago.
Yeah, I know, she is so... I did, Terry, but I couldn't get my hair done. There was no good dye. There was this awful inky stuff they'd put on it down by the river. There was henna. Ugh, it was awful. Thank God for L'Oreal.
Yeah, I know. She's so...
An acrylic. We couldn't get the acrylic nails. We did it with porcelain hundreds of years ago, Terry. It was awful. It would break. It would shatter.
She's one of my favorite characters of yours. She's the housewife from
Gross.
Long Island.
Are you a Jew? Are you, Terry, are you Jewish?
I think I'm good for the Jews.
Yeah, are you a Jew? I'm asking you a question, darling. Are you a Jew?
Yeah, Fern, yeah.
You're a Jew. You have any family like Fern?
Not exactly, but I've had neighbors.
Come on, I've had neighbors. Jews never admit there's someone like Fern in their family. You go to Florida, Terry? You have any family in Florida?
I have family in Florida, yes. I know many Ferns
where,
in Florida.
Darling, tell me. Talk to me. You like to go to the theater in Florida? They like to go to the big theaters?
It's all dinner theater.
I know. Like, they go down there to die, and they make them go to the theater, all these poor old Jews in Florida. It's so sad, isn't it? They're dragging them around to see Dreamgirls and stuff, you know.
He wants to see a show with a lot of Schwarzes.
And they drag. It's like, let them die. Don't make them go to the theater.
Is there anyone
who's the,
did you meet ever meet anyone who's the equivalent of Fern Rosenthal in Florida? I mean, in
what? Just talk about stating the obvious.
I mean, in England.
No, it was really hard. And as you're talking to them, it's like, woo, another one's died. They're going past the condos. That's all you hear the down there.
I meant to say in England.
In England, it's the Jews live in the Golders Green and Dulles Hill. Now, I'm doing an American accent here, but they're very, oh, darling, listen. They're very Jewish. It's the same thing. But to American Jews, English Jews, they got off the boat too early. They missed out. When my friend Gail Parent meets English Jews, oh, you got off the boat too early. So,
are there a lot of types you've been exposed to in America that you didn't have in England?
New York Jews, seriously, to me, are incredibly funny. I love them. And they're just, they love the foreign character. And they're very accepting of me. And, I mean, you know, I feel like I'm an honorary Jew. Yeah, no, I always see equivalents in England. I mean, there's fabulous people to impersonate in England. You know, my class system is rich. And I, of course, you know that I do HRH, the royal character that I do. One feels that one is terribly inclined to have a web page nowadays. I love that the Queen is actually on the web now.
Oh, is she? I didn't know.
Oh, is she? The royal. What did I say in my book about the Queen? I must read what I said about that. Well, not, it's not the Queen, by the way. HRH is a conglomeration of. It's the Queen's voice, I suppose. And it's Princess Margaret's lifestyle and the Duchess of Kent's hats and Princess Anne's teeth. Age 57, she has two birthdays. The day she was born, and her official birthday, a day that allows her subjects to rejoice. She has been very active recently in raising funds for a new royal yacht, something she believes is awfully important to the man in the street, even though he will never be allowed to set foot in it. Please send much-needed contributions to any one of the 14 royal houses, or contact www.hrh.commoners. So the book is full of little bits like that and information on the Queen, yeah. HRH.
And my guest is Tracy Ullman. Her new book is called Tracy Takes On, and it's a companion to her HBO series, Tracy Takes On. And this season she's taking on, let's see, music and politics and religion, I think.
Religion, smoking. Marriage, smoking. That's a good show. That's nice.
Do you smoke?
I used to.
Did you give it up?
I used to, but that was a, if I live till 80, I'll start again because I still miss it.
Do you still have dreams about smoking?
Yeah.
What happens in your smoking dreams?
I'm just at a party in the 70s again. And I just, it's funny. I'll have a great meal, I'll have a cup of coffee, and I think, oh, I'm missing something. This is, you know, I've given up for 15 years. But that was a good show, actually. That was a really good subject for all the characters. That was terrific, smoking. I've got a nice character that, because I think taking on national public radio or taking on public television or something might be funny. Because my character, Birdie Godsland, she's age 42, devout Christian, married to Bob, a tobacco industry executive. They live on Danquel Drive within a graceful, gated, guarded community with their 7 homeschooled children. And I think she just hates public radio. I think it's a tool of the devil. I really do, Miss Gross. And she's a lovely, she's my most beautiful character. She's got flicked up hair and the white teeth and the blue eyes.
And I think she's always wearing red and white.
That's right. Ain't that great? Little petites.
Tracy Ullman. Her series Tracy Takes On is on HBO Sunday nights. She also has a new companion book called Tracy Takes On. She'll be back with us in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Tracy Ullman takes on Tracy Ullman. She talks about what her performing career was like before she began writing for herself. Also, Ken Tucker reviews Sevens, the latest recording by Garth Brooks. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Tracy Ullman. She's created a gallery of characters, and she puts them into action in her HBO series, Tracy Takes On, which has started a new season on HBO. In each episode, her characters appear in a series of monologues and comic sketches related to one subject, such as smoking, marriage, music, or money. Tracy Ullman also has a new companion book called Tracy Takes On.
You had a hit record in England, which I believe is the same record that's your theme song for the HBO series.
Yes, it was nice to use that again.
Yeah, it's a good record. It's very very pop.
It's a very pop, girly tune, kind of Phil Spector wall of sound type stuff. But I never get sick of hearing it.
Oh no,
maybe other people do. No, it got to number 8 in the Billboard charts here in 84.
Now, did you ever want a serious pop music career?
No, it was just a bit of a lark, really. That was a particularly good song that was written by Kirsty MacColl, whose dad was Ewan MacColl, who wrote The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face, and he passed on his wonderful songwriting gifts to his daughter. She's married to Steve Lillywhite, who produces U2. And it was just a lark, really. I mean, I was 22 years old, and I was doing a TV comedy show in England, and they said, you sing? Why don't you make a pop record? And I did for a joke, and I went on all the TV shows, bandstand-type shows in England. I sang into my hairbrush because it was so obvious I was miming. Because, you sing into your hairbrush when you're a kid looking in the mirror.
Yeah.
And it sort of caught on, and I got a gold album, and it was an introduction to this country, actually, because I was number 8 in the charts, and I came over and I was a MTV VJ for a couple of weeks.
Oh, I didn't realise that.
That was like a guest VJ. That was, so long ago when they were on 10th Avenue, MTV, in their infancy. And everyone remembers the video because Paul McCartney was in it.
Did you ever feel that you had too much of a choice? For example, what I mean is, because you can sing, you can dance, you started off as a dancer, you can act. Did you not know what direction to go in, where your niche would be when you were starting? Before you found, the Tracy Ullman niche.
I only really act competently. I mean, I'm dancing.
You were
was
particularly
a way
good
to get my union card, and I wasn't a great dancer. I certainly wasn't, I mean, what future is there for dancing? You've got to be really good and join a wonderful ballet company or Merce Cunningham or, be a great jazz dancer. And I wasn't of that standard. I mean, I can use it within the shows that I do now. And singing, as I've mentioned, is just, I can sing in tune, but, and acting is the only thing I do really well. I always wanted to be a character actress. I've never done stand-up comedy. I mean, that was suggested, but most of the time I really don't like stand-up comedy. I don't like the rhythms and it just got so boring, especially in the early 80s.
Well, how did you end up creating so many of your own characters instead of being a character actor?
Because no one knows
in other people's movies.
Nobody knows what to do with me. I like doing my own thing. I like writing my own stuff, and I have wonderful writers, but I like doing my own thing. I've never been very good as part of someone else's vision. Apart from Woody Allen, I'd be part of his vision any day. I'd just like to create my own thing. I've realised early on that, it was difficult to cast me, so I should do my own thing.
Do you think that working as a dancer early in your career helped you get into the right posture for the different characters that you do? Because you really kind of get what their body shape, what their body positions would be. And as a dancer, you probably learned how to move muscles that I wouldn't know I even had.
Yes, probably. Yeah, that does help. But that is really important, as you just mentioned, the body posture of people. And, the walk is the type of shoes they wear and the types of cars they drive. And I mean, that just goes off body posture. But there's all sorts of things. And slowing yourself down if you're being older. And I didn't really have a lot of acting lessons. And I just didn't have time for it. I didn't, I was like, I know that bit already, And I hated all that sort of alternative method type of acting. Like, we had some crazy teacher used to come into this stage girl I went to and go, "Good morning, darlings. Let's all be dustbins." I was thinking, oh, please. I'm not going to, my arm is my lid. And I couldn't bear all that, going to the zoo and studying animal stuff. I found that sort of pretentious. And, I left school at 16 and got cracking. I find it amazing when people don't come out of school till they're like 25 and then want to sort of start acting or going into any business. I think, God, you should have been out there years ago. You're so cosseted.
You must have just had this like genetic ability to mimic other people, to kind of key into the essential traits that another person has.
It was just something I could always do. Mm-hmm. I did it for my mother in her bedroom, standing on the windowsill doing the Tracy Ullman show, impersonating the lady that lived next door and the milkman and wearing my mother's negligees and cheering her up. And I did it then, and I still think I'm doing an advanced form of that now. It's the work was a way of expressing myself and communicating, and I've always done it. But I'm very much aware of who I am and who I am at home and with my children and my husband. And there's no, you know, I'm not the sort of person that has to be on all the time. I read just John Lahr's book about his father, Bert Lahr, and it was so sort of sad. This very funny man, you know, who only was sort of felt at home being funny to people and having applause. You know, he was like sad at home and, oh, when can I get back to work type feeling. And I read that, I thought, oh gosh, if I was like that, it would be so sad.
Are you very extroverted when you're, you know, not on stage or not on mic?
I can be. I mean, I love to laugh. My husband makes me laugh. We have a lot of fun. My children have got a great sense of humour, and that is our sort of our thing, laughing. I've got, you know, energy. But I like, I'm very quiet. I like to go to bed and read at night. I don't go out. I don't like watching films or TV, unless it's funny TV like infomercials and religious stuff. I need to always take time and relax and be very quiet and be on my own. I go on retreats and things, and I don't talk and stuff like that.
Now, is it harder for you to spend time just observing people now that you're well known?
No. No, I mean, you don't need to literally be looking at them on the street. Yeah, I love documentaries, that, especially the ones that are made at HBO by a brilliant lady, Sheila Nevin, commissions these great documentaries on HBO. I watch those, and I listen to NPR a lot. And you have so much, many interviews from all around the country, all your stations. I listen to Accents. It is difficult if I say to somebody, oh, I really want to do your voice. Can you make a tape for me? And they go, oh, you want to sound like me? And then they become different. And so I don't do that directly. If I want to impersonate somebody from somewhere, I just do it anonymously and call somebody that works at a library in that town or something. But no. And people don't recognise me that much. They recognise my voice. They don't recognise me. I mean, I'm not that, oh, here she comes, you know. Tear her panties off type of celebrity.
When you're
very nice to me.
When you're learning somebody's voice, do you have to, does it come to you like in one piece, or do you have to break it down to its elements and learn it slowly?
Depends. No, it comes to me one piece. As I say, I can't listen to these Juilliard trained voice coaches or something. I mean, it's not the way I can do it, because he's not the real thing, or she's not the real thing talking. You know, I've never been able to do it that way. These dialect coaches don't do it for me. I have to listen to the person, and then I pick up more from the real person. But it's just something, you know, it's like being able to write music. You know, somebody can sit down at a piano and play it. I can just do an accent or, you know, impersonate someone and just get the mannerisms and the inside of them as well, not just the superficial stuff.
How often do you use prosthetics?
Ugh, too often, really. And that is a misery to me.
Why?
That's the worst part of my job, gluing on that rubber. Mm. And wearing beard, chick's beard, is so unbearably itchy. And I just, every time I do that character, I think, I will never do this again. And then, and then I feel I'll let the character down, so I do it. But it's murder. And by the end of a, you know, 10-week shoot, my skin is just, it's just full of glue. And I go to this French facialist, and she's like, I don't know what is coming out of your skin. I said, oh, my goodness, it smells, it's a fish glue. And they can't believe what I put on myself. That is the worst part of it. It's claustrophobic and it's irritating. And I try to find ways of just making a wig, teeth, glasses, for instance, with fern, that works. And I think let that be the main part of the character and don't try and do all this aging and everything, because it really doesn't count for much on the screen, a small screen as well, which is TV, what I'm doing.
Now, how does it affect you when you get a prosthetic on your face and you maybe look in the mirror and you see yourself transformed? Does that help you get into the character?
Oh, yes. It's great. I mean, like when I first put on the black makeup gave myself, you know, different nose and different lips and a different texture, you know, a bigger neck and chin. And, oh, it's fantastic. I mean, it's great fun when you first put it on. And teeth, as I say, they help enormously.
My guest is Tracy Ullman. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Tracy Ullman, her series Tracy Takes On has started a new season on HBO. Now, what's it like for you to interact with the writers on your show? Are you all in the same room at the same time writing?
Yes, we meet every week and I'm sort of the head writer. I sit at the top of the table and probably because I can stop them all going to the toilet and making phone calls all the time because writers tend to do that. And we meet every Wednesday. And I assign stuff for everybody and we come back the following Wednesday. And obviously I can read it all through and I'm going to be the one performing it. And it gives us a good, you know, sense of what's going on. And we have a great laugh. I have a great group of writers. And I write with various combinations of them or on my own during the week.
And are there characters that you write yourself?
All the characters I created and I presented them to them. Mm-hmm. And I tell them... I demonstrate and I go into character and say this is how they, you know, and while I'm in character, sometimes I'm dressed up during the season, I can come up with plot ideas because I can imagine how to further the characters' lives. And but I have great writers. I mean, I have a guy called Jerry Belson who was on the Dick Van Dyke Show back in the 60s and, you know, he's been on everything. You know, when he got nominated for the Tracy Ullman Show, he said, "That's my first nomination in colour." and he's just a brilliant person to have because he's just a brilliant one-liner man and he's got a million plots. It didn't work in 1963. I'll use it now. And I have two English gentlemen called Ian Lefrenet and Dick Clement who are superb. Superb writers, story writers. I have George McGrath, who used to be on Pee Wee Herman's Playhouse. And I have women. I have Molly Newman and Gail Parent and Jenji Cohen. I mean, I'm one of the only people that has one of these shows that does have women writers in equal numbers.
What were the comedies or who were the comic figures that you really liked when you were young?
I loved all the old Ealing comedies. I loved Alec Guinness and Peter Sellers in I'm All Right, Jack. And I mean, I'm very inspired by people like Vanessa Redgrave. I think she's just the most incredible actress, not necessarily in the comic sense, but, you know, just great acting like that. And I used to see Gilda Radner in the late 70s. They started showing Saturday Night Live in England. And I thought, wow, what a great thing to do. That looks so much fun. I do that. I can do that. And I used to get Carol Burnett. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, mm-hmm. growing up, and Lucille Ball. I mean, we're very Americanized. Although television in England when I was a kid was very American.
I think your father was a lawyer and passed away when you were six.
That's right, yeah.
So did your mother remarry? Or?
Yes, mm-hmm. yes, disastrously.
Oh, really?
Now we come to the sad part of the interview. This is the Barbara Walters interview. This is the point where you'd make me cry. And it was just so terrible. No, it was. It wasn't very much fun. I didn't have much fun really till I left home
at 16.
My mum's great, but it was kind of tough. You lose your dad, and then you know you've always there was no money, and it's like hurry up and get a job and get out of the house, and it was kind of hard work.
So you left home when you were what, 16?
Yeah, went to Berlin.
Oh, with a dance group.
Oh. And then I just took various jobs. Never really came home again.
Did anyone think that you had any chance in show business?
No, because they said I wasn't pretty enough. My uncle used to say, "You look like a troll." She's funny, but she looks like a troll, doesn't she?
That's a real confidence booster.
I know. Do you remember those trolls who comb their long hair? And
yes, absolutely.
On, you know.
Yeah.
So, No. I'm being harsh. They weren't that nasty about me. No, they always encouraged. My mum really encouraged me. And could see that I was humorous and... But I was, as I said, I wasn't a conventional looker. I was an odd-looking little thing. And they, you know, So they sort of, and someone said, oh, you're like Beatrice Lilly, maybe. When I
started. Well, do you think that that was an obstacle early on before you really found yourself as a performer, that you weren't, you know, beautiful in the classic Hollywood sense?
Yeah. I mean, that's always a thing for an actress. I mean, because there is a great onus sometimes put on a woman's looks if you're going to be in film and TV. And, you know, I'm not a dog, but I'm not, as I say, you know. So I was kind of aware of that. But then you just play to your strengths. And, you know, all the pretty girls couldn't do all these characters and weren't half the actress I was. I mean, there's always a place for a good comic actress, good character actress, and that's me.
Are you still doing any work in England?
The shows have just started to be shown on Channel 5 in England, and I'm very glad about that. And they get a sort of, they've gotten a good response, a kind of, oh, you know, it's too American for us, maybe, response. But I think they'd like me to make some more shows in England. And I think it would be a nice idea if I did maybe three or four of the takes on shows in England, you know, takes on the society season, takes on the French, takes on the Edinburgh Festival. I mean, there's some good English subjects.
Let me ask you, you spoof the royal family in your performances. What impact did it have on your ability to satirize the royal family when Princess Diana was killed? Did that make you feel like you had to, like, stop for a little while? Or?
Yeah, I mean, it was just a horrible time that, you know, it was. And I did have a piece on my show, in the royalty show, where Sidney Cross sends a video to Princess Diana saying, you know, let me represent you in your divorce. You know, this guy was now prince. I'm going to get you half of Wales. And it was very funny when we showed it, you know, and became, you know, sort of not apt when the princess died. And I had sent that show to the Princess of Wales when she was alive, obviously. And I sent it to Kensington Palace, and I wrote her a letter, and I said, look, I really admire you. I think you need a few laughs. I will not use your response as any sort of publicity, and best regards. And she watched it and got her lady-in-waiting or secretary to call back and say how much she'd enjoyed it. And I would never have mentioned that while she was alive, but it was because I do admire her. I like that she stood up and said, look, there's something wrong here. You know, she didn't sort of sit back and accept. I mean, I really was a great admirer of hers. I liked her. I met her a couple of times, and she was nice to my children.
Oh, well, that's great. Were you kind of enamored by royalty when you were young?
No, never. I didn't understand it. I didn't know what example they were setting to us. I used to go to the Royal Windsor Horse Show, and everyone would crowd around and watch the Queen go round in a carriage in one of those dreadful hats that looked like they'd been designed in Moscow. And I don't know, what is it? Why are they better than us? What have they done? Well, I just didn't get it. And I still don't. I mean, it's just, I don't know. You know, it's just a very, they set the precedent as the pinnacle of our class system, which is, you know, at times very inhibiting and very destructive in England. And I'm not, you know, I'm not happy with it. And since Diana's death, it has, these questions have been raised more and more with the British public, and things that I was talking about 10 years ago that seemed inappropriate and were, you know, condemned by the press in England, now it's very acceptable. And I just hope that within the next century we can dismantle the House of Lords, this hereditary peerage thing in England. And wouldn't it be nice to have a, you know, if not a republic, just a bicycling monarchy like they have in Holland and Scandinavia, where they aren't paid millions and millions and millions of pounds to be better than us. And that's just how I feel, you know. I don't want to line them up and shoot them. You know, I'm not, because I don't get it, you know, and what can I say?
Tracy Ullman, it's just been a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's lovely to talk to you. It really is.
Tracy Ullman's HBO series, Tracy Takes On, is shown Sunday nights. Later this month, the programs will be available on home video. Ullman also has a new book called Tracy Takes On. Here's her record, They Don't Know, which was a hit in England in the mid-'80s and is now the theme to her HBO series. Baby, there's no need for living in the past. Now I found good love and gonna make it last. I tell the others.
night, Trace.
Good night, Trace. Good night, Trace.
Good night,
Trace.
Go home. Go home.
Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Garth Brooks' latest recording. This is Fresh Air. Garth Brooks' latest collection called Sevens is a country music crossover success. It was number one on the Billboard pop charts for 5 weeks in a row, the first time anyone's done that in more than 2 years. This week it slipped to number two. Rock critic Ken Tucker says that Brooks is the country superstar most intent on being a pop star, and he thinks Sevens is a shrewd but problematic move.
That old wind that's whipping out there, it's whistling your tune. That wind blew pyramids to Egypt and footprints to the moon. And that old star that you've been wishing on is shining mighty bright. But it's the fire inside your heart that's gonna lead you into the light. How you ever gonna know what it's like?
Sevens is the album that reorganized a record company. Early last year, Garth Brooks had completed his new album, but was feuding with his label, Capitol Records in Nashville, over when and how to release it. On stage, the key to Brooks's appeal is to make himself look like a very aggressive guy who's also a very sensitive guy. In his business dealings, he apparently drops the sensitive part. Dissatisfied with the marketing campaign Capitol Nashville had come up with, Brooks withheld the album from them and insisted on dealing with Capitol's New York office, which he felt better appreciated his country-transcending status. Sevens was supposed to be released to coincide with the free concert in New York's Central Park that Brooks had scheduled for August. That concert proved a big success, attracting an urban audience of hundreds of thousands that ratified Brooks's crossover appeal. But his willful delay had thrown off the production schedule of Sevens, and it wasn't in the stores to capitalize on the concert. It finally came out last month with a first single that sounded like a stubborn guy's manifesto.
Sometimes you've got to take the heat. If you're gonna walk down on the main street, take the heat. And you see it through. Cause sometimes it comes down to what you gotta do.
It's a measure of Garth Brooks's drawing power that, even after the corporate temper tantrum he threw, one that resulted in a round of executive replacements down in Nashville, his album still went through the roof, streaking to number one despite competition from albums by Celine Dion, Leanne Rimes, and Barbara Streisand, precisely the sort of middle-of-the-road power players that Brooks wants to compete with. And this is where I must say I admire Brooks's grandiose ambitions. Unlike the competition, his big, overblown songs are meticulous in their details and imagery. They build emotions with some subtlety, as in this prime example.
Drove to the church in my suit and tie, but I just couldn't bring myself to go inside. So I sat alone in my truck across the street. Watch that chauffeur smoking cigarettes by that long white limousine. I could just imagine what was going on in there. Sunlight streaming through the stained glass on those flowers in your hair.
And in less time than it takes a tear to fall, those bells rang loud as thunder as they opened up the doors. Now I don't have to wonder anymore.
Garth Brooks's country music is as much influenced by Billy Joel and the Eagles as it is by Hank Williams and George Jones. Designed for mass compromise, it's not the kind of country I usually like. Add to this lyrics that frequently come across as rhymed glosses on the collected wisdom of self-help guru Tony Robbins, and there's a lot of stuff here, melodramatic and banal, that I don't have any use for. But for an overreaching egomaniac, he manufactures an awfully well-crafted product, and I don't begrudge Garth Brooks the millions of consumers that he satisfies.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly.
Long neck bottom, let go my hand. And jukebox don't start playing that song again. 'Cause there's a girl at home who loves me, you know she won't understand. Long neck bottom, let go my hand. Yourself long neck bottom, let go my hand. Won't you box down, stop playing that song again? 'Cause there's a girl at home who loves me, you know she won't understand. Long neck bottom, let go my hand.
Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu and Monique Nazareth. Research assistance from Sarah Scherer. Roberta Schurach directs the show. I'm Tariq Rose.
That dance floor seems to underneath my feet everywhere I turn. All the walks right out of them swinging doors. That's a step I just can't learn. Long neck bottle, let go my hand. Jukebox, don't stop playing that song again. 'Cause there's a girl at home who loves me, you know she won't understand. Long neck bottom, let go my hand. There's a girl at home who loves me, you know she won't understand. Long.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.